Hey there, guys. Alex Lokes here, and we are still in the heat of summer at the moment, which means it's a perfect time to dive back several decades to the 1980s. Loud hair, loud colors, and even louder music, and some incredibly loud cameras, but that does not mean that there weren't any real hits that decade, and I'm not just talking music, I'm also talking about cameras here, so let's do the Bill and Ted and go on an excellent adventure.
Coming to you live from Toronto, Canada, this is the Classic Camera Revival. If you don't have gear acquisition syndrome now, you certainly will after listening to our show.
Like I said, 1980s, you just started seeing autofocus come into play, and some of those early autofocus cameras were pretty loud in regards to the motor. Thankfully, every single camera, mostly around the table, are manual focus, which is great because we can then let the hair speak for itself. So, first up, we have Mike with a Hasselblad, well, an attempted Hasselblad killer, and that's the Bronica SQ-AI.
I do have the SQ-AI, although the SQ-AI technically is a 90s camera. The model hadn't changed too much since it was released in the 80s.
That would be the SQ-A.
Yeah. Like the SQ came out, yada, 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 back in 1980 because they were getting rid of their focal plane shutter models and now going to a leaf in the lens kind of model, which they were already on the right track originally when they started to add the electronic controls to it, which meant that shutter timings were exact. And there would be very, very little possibility of them going out of whack due to mechanical issues, although instead they jam up completely and don't fire if you don't have a battery. Needless to say, the SQ, the SQ-AI, the SQ-B, whatever particular model, as long as it's not the AM, which is the model that we will never speak of.
Horrible.
Exactly. They're actually really, really nice to use. They have a they feel really good in the hand. The only thing is, and this is actually something that I've noticed that Alex has really picked on when it came to the SQ, was they're not the most ergonomically nice to hold in hand, especially with the eye level prism. Yep. I don't know what it is about 6x6 cameras, but the eye level prism doesn't work with them. Yet, at the same time, I know John likes using the prism on his Hasselblad, but I have a feeling it's more along the lines of not so much that it's the prism and the way it was, than the ergonomic. I have a feeling more that it's a 45.
It's the angle.
Yeah, and I have a feeling that will make a huge difference because of the design of the camera, especially they're boxy, they're not the most ergonomically easy to hold. And I find holding it right up to my eye, using the prism to shoot, I have issues doing that. That was actually one of the issues I also had with the ETRS. Although it's a 645 format, shooting with it and using the eye level prism, I don't really like using it because of the eye level prism, but I can't use it with the waist level finder because it's not 6x6. So what I find is using that style camera with a camera hand grip or the speed grip or whatever you want to call it, I find that makes a huge difference. So going with the SQ, I would recommend ditching the eye level prism and just sticking to a waist level finder, because it doesn't matter how you shoot this camera, whether it's above your head, to the side or anything, it's a square format.
Yep.
There's no portrait orientation. You can crop after if you want, but at the same time, it's square. You'd be cropping after if you're going to do an 8x10, 11x14, like any of the traditional standard size prints, you're doing a crop. So I wouldn't worry too much about using an eye level prism. Just shoot low. It makes life a lot easier, and I just find it's not as awkward.
Now, that being said, with the eye level prism, having an action grip.
The action grip
makes it so much easier.
Does it ever? I love having the action grip or the speed grip. It really, really makes a world of difference with this camera. It changed my perception when I was shooting the ETRS. I found it a lot easier, especially since the ETRS is already in a portrait orientation since it's a 6x9 half frame. And setting up the ETRS to shoot landscapes using the speed grip it's so much easier. So much easier. And I use it with the iLevel Prism just because of the way it's formatted. And using the SQAI with an iLevel Prism and the Speed Grip, that makes the whole world of difference as well. So if you do get one and you do have the iLevel Prism, invest a little bit more and get the Speed Grip. You'll thank me for it.
Absolutely, and that was always the one problem I had with the SQAI, is that I had the iLevel Prism, I didn't have the grip.
Yeah.
And to actually buy a waist level finder for those cameras, you can buy the cameras cheap. Like, yeah. you can sing a dirty song and they'll just basically give it to you.
And one, two.
I'll have to tell you the French fighter pilot joke one time.
No, but you're absolutely right. The bodies are dirt cheap. And the whole thing is, you look at the price of the body, and a lot of time they come with a waist level finder. And then you look at everything else that it comes with. It comes with the lens. It comes with the back. Like, yeah, that's great. But, I mean, you're looking at about $300-$400 for it. And honestly, it's really not that bad when you consider the alternatives of being like, say, if you want a 6x6, what, Hasselblad or Olaflex.
You're looking at investing 1,000 plus.
Yeah. Right? So the Bronica is a very inexpensive 6x6 system camera. I mean, it's probably right on par with the Pentacon 6 as far as pricing goes.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a little more modern and electronic. You get better flash sync speeds because you can do it at 1/500. But,
and again, you're working with a price. System camera, so that even if the body kicks it,
you can get another one.
You just buy another one, and it's like $100 on KH.
But it's the waist level finder, the stupid chimney. It's
You're looking at over $100, $200 for those. Yeah, it's absurd. Nuts.
And yeah,
it's the same for the Mamiya M645 system. You can buy one dirt cheap with an eye level finder and a non-working meter, but as soon as you start looking at a waist level finder, you're like, really?
Yeah,
all I have to start selling my dog.
Flaps of metal to block light.
Yeah,
I mean, in all honesty, you could make one out of a little bit of cardboard, some electrical tape, and there you go, just to shade it. But
yeah, I've seen it.
Would look pretty terrible.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I mean, it's a lot cheaper than spending almost $200 Canadian for basically the exact same thing. So if you can get one and you are interested in it, you may want to look more at getting a model with the waist level finder already on it.
Yep.
It would be the more recommended idea to go with. And then if you want to try the iLevel Prism, they're usually pretty inexpensive.
Yeah,
you could probably get the metered one fairly inexpensive.
Get the unmetered one. The meter one just sucks through batteries like nobody's business.
Yeah. Yes, it does. Yes, it does. And that's the other sticking point on it, is the batteries. It went from using the 544 PX28 battery that you can use on A-series cameras, the older Bronicas, the ETRS, the GS1. It's a pretty standard battery. I mean, it's even used for medical devices. It's a 6-volt battery that you can buy at drugstores. You can buy at Walmart. You can order it online pretty much anywhere. And it's fairly inexpensive, and you can use it in a wide range of cameras. Now, Bronica went with four
button cells.
The buttons, LR44s.
And that little flap just pops open like nobody's business. I mean, I had to tape it.
Yeah, well, I do too. It's either I tape it or I put a tripod mount on it just to hold the door shut. Because I've had it, I go out shooting and push the button and nothing happens. Why? My battery door fell open, the batteries fell out, and now I'm searching through the grass, not for the little battery holder, but all the batteries went spring, and they're all everywhere.
All over the place. Yeah, absolutely. It's horrible.
And if you lose that battery holder, your body is basically dead.
Dead. Yep.
Because it's just such a stupid design. And if you're using button cell, you'd figure you just have little compartments in the camera, not a holder.
Yeah.
Why do you need a holder? Olympus didn't do it, and they had to, and they used them. Nikon, they had a holder for two batteries stacked.
What were they thinking?
Exactly. Damn you, Bronica. Damn you.
Well, moving right along. The next camera is Donna and the Ricoh XRP.
Yes, today I'll be using the Ricoh XRP. It is a single lens SLR camera, and it was introduced in 1984. Now, this camera is one of my favorite cameras to use. I like it because it's small, but the only downfall I don't like about it is it's not extremely light. It's actually got quite a heavy weight to it.
Which is funny because it looks like it's made of plastic.
It does, and it's really not made of plastic. It's actually the winder that's on the bottom that is the plastic. But even without the winder on, it's still... Yeah,
the winder is super light.
It's really...
The winder is tiny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's good for people with small hands, too, which is another reason why I like it.
I was thinking more of the president of our southern neighbor.
Now this camera... this camera uses a Pentax K-mount.
Nice.
And the optics on this is absolutely phenomenal. The quality of the pictures is just...
Now you have the Ricoh glass on that?
I have the Ricoh glass on this.
No, Vivitar.
Vivitar, yes.
Oh, yeah,
Vivitar
well, 52. Enough said.
Yeah, it's actually inexpensive to use, so or to buy. So if you're looking at getting a camera to buy for your first time, I would really recommend buying it. Retails for about roughly...
I don't know. This particular model I had bought for this particular model I had bought for Donna, and what I paid all in for lens, body, absolutely brand new speed grip in box, plastic and everything unopened. I think the glass was the most expensive at $40, but the camera and
most expensive at $40.
The camera and grip I was actually less shipped to us, and the grip came as is, and I thought, what the heck, it's like $5, why not? And sure enough, and it works perfect, and the grip makes it actually does make the camera a little bit easier to use and a little more ergonomic, just because it has like the action grip kind of style. But it's the shutter sound that I think is so funny. It's
small sound.
It's very small. It almost sounds like a sneeze.
Yeah, it's actually pretty cute. And I also like it because it is a programmable camera as well, so you don't need to.
So it has full auto exposure. Nice. Yeah.
Looks like the whole PASM is on there.
Yeah,
it's got a few different program modes.
I don't know what the heck the different program modes are. It's just I just set it and kind of walk away. But yeah, you can use it also as a full manual camera as well.
Nice.
Interesting.
That's a pretty decent camera. And as I said, the pictures that you get, the quality is absolutely amazing for such a small little camera. Yeah.
It's got three different program modes, it looks like. It's got aperture priority and shutter priority. But I wonder what the three different modes are. I have to check that out.
Yeah.
Definitely something to try. You know, if you're iffy on purchasing it, borrow it from a friend first, and I guarantee you'd really like the camera.
Not to mention, with the K-mount, you have access to so many lenses.
That's a great point. Yeah.
Yep.
Now,
K-mount lenses are fairly inexpensive, too.
Yep, so absolutely.
$25 to $40 per lens. So
yeah.
Definitely a good kit to buy.
Not bad. Not bad. Well, moving right along, the next camera has been one that has been featured on the podcast before. It's been used by several of us around the table. And extremely iconic, and very underappreciated, and I think it would almost be a cult status, and that would be the Nikon FA.
The Nikon FA. Listen to this. Doesn't that just scream 1983 to you?
Any more 83, they'll probably get the Duran Duran video.
How old was I in 1983? Good Lord. I think I was
in grade 10.
I was,
I was born in 83.
12 years old. I think I was going in, I was in grade 8. Oh my, just shut up, Alex.
I was born?
I was born. Friggin' millennials.
Alex was barely two strands of separate DNA. I was like a junior in high school.
Good I was Lord. In third year university. Get off my lawn.
Anyway, so 1983 was, in a previous episode, we talked about the crossroads of rangefinders and SLRs. And in 83, I think, was a crossroads in automation and autofocus versus manual focus and non-programmable cameras. And really, when Nikon introduced this thing, it was actually marketed as the Techno Camera in 1983. And that's because, and I'm going to get into it a little further in the discussion, about the metering modes and the first program, shutter speed, aperture priority, and manual all-in-one camera. This camera really represents, it's the foundational camera, I think, for all modern-day SLRs, including digital today. And a lot of the functionality that's in this camera is still relevant by today's standards, especially for a camera that was only manufactured for about 5 years.
Which is short for Nikon.
Absolutely, very short for Nikon.
Actually, I think it was
They stopped manufacturing. It was discontinued in 88, so...
Yeah.
And that, you know, it was discontinued because the F4 had come out.
That's right.
And the only real, I think one of the biggest drivers of it being discontinued was the dawn of autofocus. And people wanted autofocus because they had really mastered, I guess, automatic metering. So this camera, it's got program auto exposure. So the program mode, it's actually one of the, if not the first, one of the first cameras with an actual computer chip. To calculate exposure, and that's because it's the first ever matrix mode metering that was offered by any of the manufacturers. So it has basically two metering modes. It has center weighted and matrix, and there's a switch on the lower right hand side of the lens. So typically, where you would find the depth of field preview on most cameras, there's a little push in button, and you push it in. And turn it and lock it, and that changes it to center weighted. Or if you release it, it stays in matrix mode.
Matrix, yeah.
And obviously, with the advent of color, it means, doesn't it? It sounds like it's in charge, doesn't it? Yeah. You know what? It's funny. Like a lot of that MD12 winder. That's where a lot of you get a lot of the sound effects these days.
Actually, it's more from the F3 and it's
motor
drive.
It's motor drive. Yeah. So, so this camera, you know, terrific. Obviously, requires batteries. It's an electronic camera. So two LR44s power the camera, and obviously, without those batteries working well, you pretty much have a doorstop. But those batteries they're a dime a dozen. They're easy to find. There's a couple of
plus if you have the proper motor drive.
If you have so this camera has is compatible with two separate motor drives. There's the MD12, which is kind of the universal motor drive that Nikon had put out for all of the sort of F sub variants. So like the FA, FM, FE. FEs all took the MD12. In fact, my FM3A, I have the same MD12 motor drive for that camera. But they also made a specific motor drive for this camera called the MD15. And the main difference between the MD15 and the MD12 is with the MD15, it actually powered the meter and the body. So you didn't actually, if your body batteries died, it didn't matter as long as your winder worked. However, with the MD12, they both operate independently. So in order for your meter to work, you need the body button cells in there. It's interesting. Many of the features of the FA were not available on the F3, surprisingly. And they were both professional cameras. But the F3 was the professional camera for this vintage, which was less featured and also had its own problems when it first came out. The F3 without the high point viewfinder was problematic, but like the F3 HP, beautiful camera. But the F3 HP to me is more akin to the FM3A these days than the FA. The FA was kind of like its own version. So if you look at, and you know, this is just, I guess, rumor, but like FA in my world, FA stands for fully automatic, FE stands for fairly electronic, and FM is like fully manual. And whether or not that's true with Nikon, if that was their intention, Bill might know. I don't know.
But, I don't know. You're probably not far off because FM would be fully mechanical.
Or mechanical, rather, not manual. Yeah.
But it's funny. I really don't know much about the FA. I never own one, and I'm just sitting here going, oh, damn, gosh.
It's a beautiful camera.
Yeah, I've just never shot with one, so I have no experience with it whatsoever.
Yeah.
They are beautiful cameras.
Yeah. It's the camera that will outsmart you.
I bought mine off of John, and when we did our Let's All Shoot One Camera episode, it's like, yeah, I kind of want one now. And then listen to an FPP episode where Leslie talked on the FA, and I'm like, yeah, I really want one now.
Yeah, it's amazing. Like, that's the camera. When I first got into photography in 1989 when I was 16, and the FA was the camera that I wanted, because it had every, and like, you know, when you're learning photography, you're always being preached at, get a manual camera. I'm like, yeah, but I'm a nerd and I want the top of the line, fully automatic, fully electronic. And the nice thing about the FA is you can shoot it in manual mode as well too. So
skill testing question: where's the fair market value for a decent FA body that doesn't require, like, can you find one in the wild that doesn't...
$200 Canadian?
Okay, that sounds pretty good.
About right.
Yeah, they're not.
Oh,
like an FM3A.
Someone's developing like if gas you find, right like, now.
You can find
on air.
Yeah, gas happens. It just does. That's gear acquisition syndrome, people, not flatulence.
And gear acquisition syndrome, there is no cure, just temporary remission.
Exactly.
Speaking from experience.
And for $200, does that get you eBay Minty or one that works?
One that works. You can get a good example for around 200 Canadians on what is that, like, I don't know, at the way things are going with the U.S.?
About 76
After the tariffs, I don't know, what's that going to cost?
Well, unless... President.
Before or after the wall.
Yeah.
unless
they're actually not bad.
Oh, really? Oh, Alex is pulling up.
Are you looking on Fleabay?
I'm looking on eBay.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, they're a couple hundred bucks.
They're like upwards of like $250.
Okay. That's not too bad.
I paid $225 for mine with the winder.
Okay. I didn't need a winder.
Yeah.
Anyway, I have a local guy in Toronto called F-Stop Camera.
Oh, yeah. Yes. I'm familiar with him.
That's where I bought that.
Kind of goofy hours, but...
Goofy hours, but you call the guy, send him a text, you meet him. He's got a huge inventory.
I bought a Pentax KX off him a few years back. And I'm definitely probably going to head back there
for the guys
I got an
exacta
for $30.
In the GTA, look on Kijiji, F-Stop.
Yep. Photo accessories.
Cameras and photo accessories or whatever. Look up. You'll find it. F-Stop photo accessories.
He's sort of young. The closest is a Young Eglinton subway, and then you got to walk north a few blocks.
Yeah. Anyway, good inventory. Good guy.
One thing you do have to watch out for, especially on the FA, is the type of Nikon lens you mount on it to get that full program mode.
Yes.
You need the AIS lenses to get your full program mode.
Well, yes and no. So the way that the metering system works, so it has basically, it has two program modes. It has a normal and a high speed mode.
Right.
So in order to access the high speed mode, you need an AIS lens. You need the AI lens for the full program to work. Okay. Non-AI lenses, you're obviously not going to get full program. You're going to get stop-down metering, et cetera. Nothing's going to be indexed. Basically, the way that it works, but the difference between the AI and the AIS essentially is when you put an AI lens of 135 millimeter, or an AIS lens rather, of 135 or longer focal length, the program shifts three stops. So if it goes when it is long like that, it basically it selects the fast program setting. So if you look on the back of an AIS lens, you'll see there's a little notch in the back of the, like, on the mounting plate, and that's what signals to the camera, hey, I have an AIS lens and I can go into the faster shutter speed modes because I have a longer lens.
Right.
So basically what it's saying is, well, I'm going to eliminate camera shake, so I'm going to switch to high speed mode because I've got a 135 or greater focal length. I'm going to eliminate shorter length. So when I do calculate my program exposures, it's going to be the faster shutter speed ranges, which is going to be basically, you know, one over the focal length or whatever, or the reciprocal. It's going to follow that standard rule to eliminate
This is kind of what I meant when Bill was asking about it, and I said that it was the camera that outsmarts you, and this is kind of what I was more leading towards.
Yes, it protects you, I guess, or it looks out for you, I suppose. But outsmart you? Well, it depends on how good of a photographer you are, I guess. But yeah.
Well, if I wind up with an FA in my future, I will just say, James, it's all your fault.
It's all my fault. You're pretty welcome, much. Bill.
And bang, he just bought one.
And then just bought one. So, but the older AI lenses will only run in the standard program mode, which is fine. It's not really limiting. All you gotta remember is that, you know, you can take your program metering mode if you know you're gonna have camera shake. Because let's say you got like a 200 millimeter AI lens on there or something. Who knows?
Just put it into shutter priority mode.
Put it
into
shutter priority, and then you're good. Fine. Yeah. Interestingly, this meter that's different than the other Nikon cameras of that era. The meter just kind of stays on the whole time. So yes. Once you depress the shutter, like, you know, typically most meters are, they'll stay on for 30 seconds and they'll shut off. This thing basically stays on for like 4 or 5 minutes. And it's got an interesting way that it meters. It's basically called a closed loop system.
Yeah.
So basically what that does, it takes a meter reading right up until, this is in program mode, of course, any of the program modes, it takes a meter reading right up until just before the shutter releases, and this is when the aperture has closed down to whatever aperture you set it at. So it actually meters like a split second before that, adjusts it if necessary.
Yeah.
So then you're getting accurate metering right up until the point of exposure, whereas other cameras, you know, it'll take the meter reading and then it stays there. It doesn't adjust it.
Yeah.
Like once you've depressed the shutter,
it saved my skin on like some horrible, like deep foggy mornings where it's like, oh, I'm getting a da-da-da-da, and then all of a sudden the sun just shines out just briefly and click.
Yeah.
Like, oh yeah, there we go.
And it's really helpful because a lot of like modern cameras, like modern lenses today, there's a calibration of the actual diaphragm and the lens and how that diaphragm behaves in the lens. So during the lens design process, they will calibrate that diaphragm to certain, like to achieve a certain exposure. The FA does that calculation with that closed loop system automatically. So, you know, obviously in the right contrast light, you're going to get pretty much bang on exposures 100% of the time. One annoying thing about this camera, when you're not using it with the winder, you have to pull out the advanced lever to switch the camera on, to switch the meter on, which can be a little bit of a pain in the ass.
Well, that was pretty much standard for most Nikon cameras of the era. The FM, the FE, they all have the same system. It's tripped me up before.
Oh, yeah. And you get spoiled these days with a digital camera because you don't have to worry about that lever anymore.
Yep.
And then, if you know, you're going back and forth between a DSLR and a film camera, you know, you remember that it's there. So
I've done that before.
Yeah. Interestingly, this camera, not really necessarily interestingly, but it does. It has an LCD display in the viewfinder for all your shutter speeds, which was something that also in 1983 was, novelty factor was extremely high because, hey, it's got an LCD. How modern, you know, so pretty cool.
Actually, it looks like, looking through the viewfinder at first glance, it looks like an F3.
It does, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
To the point, I wonder if some of the parts are interchangeable.
It's possible. That's why I have my F3 sitting at the table here, and you can see how similar those. Look at the F3, the FM3A, and the FA. And if we had an FM2 and an FE here, it'd be hard. Yeah. The silhouettes of the cameras would look the same, other than the high point viewfinder of the F3, which is
actually identical. The high point viewfinder is just a little bit taller than the one on the FA.
Yeah.
And the FA has the green skylight.
Yes,
in it.
Yes. So really interesting. Like most Nikon cameras of this era, when you first load the film, before the film counter advances to one, it basically locks the shutter speed at 1/250th of a second,
which is great.
Yeah, so you'll see it'll read C250 in the in the viewfinder, and then you know, hey, I've just loaded film in this thing and I haven't advanced it to frame one. So if you really want to, you know, be thrifty with your film, then stop down meter and do whatever you got to do to match the 1/250th shutter speed and get yourself a couple extra frames. You know, as with the modern Nikon, so if you're putting like a non-gelded lens on any of the modern Nikon bodies, you've got to close the aperture all the way down for any of the automatic settings to yep. work. Same thing with this camera. You know, it's really, it's an incredible camera. The first program exposure camera, matrix metering. You know, I'm the first one to admit I am one of the biggest Nikon fanboys there are. I love Nikon. I grew up shooting Nikon. I just think Nikon is the bee's knees when it comes to quality. You know, like, and I'm not, you know, not to disparage Canon or Olympus or, you know, any of these other manufacturers, but when it comes to consumer and professional level cameras, I find the consistency with Nikon has always been the best selling point. Like, you buy a Nikon lens, it doesn't matter if you buy the pro grade lens or you buy the consumer lens, you're going to get this. You may not get the same build quality, but you're going to get the same optical quality. Whereas I find in my experience, I've shot a lot of Canon systems, digital film. Canon copies are hit and miss when it comes to their glass, which is sad because they do make a great product, but yep. I have a problem with their consistency or lack of consistency, rather. So, you know, first camera with the program, aperture priority, shutter speed, and manual, the whole PASM, which is the foundation for exposure today. In my opinion, like this, I call this camera my Goldilocks camera. You know, it's not too big, it's not too small, it's just right. You know. All of the controls, like this is why you gotta love Nikon. Like, if you're a photographer, you gotta love Nikon because all the bloody controls, they're in the right spot.
Yep,
they're where your fingers go. Canon, hello.
Well, with me, James, you are preaching to the converted because I am a Nikon fanboy at heart. But I guess I'm the one taking over here. My 1980s camera, and And again, you know, referencing Olympus, I brought in the OM4. I could have brought in an OM2N, but that was kind of like one of those that was introduced in the late 1970s, and they produced those up to 1984, whereas the OM4 came in 1985. It was a manual focus. It was an aperture priority camera as well, so you can shoot manual mode or aperture priority mode. It was geared towards, I guess, if Nikon and Canon were geared to photojournalists and, you know, say Nikon photojournalists, fashion photographers, and Canon basically photojournalists, sports photographers, I guess, wildlife photographers, Olympus was kind of geared more to almost the scientific community and I call it the adventurers, because again, we never really talked Olympus at the CCR because, well, there's really only one other Olympus shooter at this table, and that's Donna, and one of these days we'll have probably just us chatting about the OM2N in depth. But
that's because these people don't know what's the good cameras to use.
I know. What are you going to do?
The Olympics? I'm going to boycott the Olympics. What?
Anyway, getting back to the Olympus OM4, it was very revolutionary in some regards because you had sort of like your standard center-weighted metering, but it also had built-in spot metering. So you can take about three different readings and come up with an average. It was really brilliant.
So, you know, while you're on that subject, one thing I didn't mention, I have a question, I guess, for the table. When I shoot black and white film, I do not use matrix metering. I use center weighted metering because of the exposure latitude with black and white film. And I find that I get better results with center weighted and spot metering, of course, I use. Mm-hmm. But I stay away from matrix. I was just curious what others do.
Well, that's funny. I just use center weighted myself. Like, I've experimented with matrix on my Nikon N90S one December with an autofocus lens. So everything, I could actually do matrix metering. But, you know, again, with the Olympus, it's really the only time I've used that is when I've got a really tricky shot where I've got two extremes in the exposure scale, and it's like, okay, how can I salvage this as best I can? And it gets me out about 80% of the time. It being an Olympus, it's a very compact camera. So if you're one into backpacking, off-grid, and you don't want to take like a full size Nikon or say a Nikon or a Canon kit, yeah, the Olympus is a great alternative. There, and regular OM4s are easy to reasonably easy to find, whereas the mechanical OM3s are much more of a collector camera. They weren't made anywhere near as many, and again, you're looking at probably a $250 premium between the two. There is one Achilles heel with the OM4, and it shares that same Achilles heel with the OM2 Spot program, which was sort of made around the same time. It eats batteries. Alex is going to be doing an extended review of the OM4 at a later date, which I've loaned to my my faithful OM4. And I have instructed him, when you're done shooting with it, take the batteries out. And these batteries, of course, are your basic ubiquitous SR44s, Energizer 357s. You can find at just about any supermarket on planet Earth. As for the OM4, again, they're out there. They're reasonably attainable. You're looking at maybe $200-$300 for a rather clean copy. And if you want the more improved OM4T, which is more of a 1990s body than an 80s body, the OM4T or TI, you're looking at about $500. And, of course, you're not going through as many Energizer 357 batteries. So, you know, pick your poison. I love my OM4, but again, I'm a Nikon fanboy that also likes his Olympus too.
Well, I don't talk about Minolta a lot, but I started off in my photography journey with Minolta cameras, with a Hi-Matic 7S. Then moved on to an SRT-102, and then the last Minolta camera I had was an X7A. And it was a fantastic camera. So when I had the chance to get my hands on another Minolta SLR, slightly newer than the X7A, I jumped at it. And that was the XGM. Now, if you're a fan of Minolta, you'll know the XG series is a bunch of semi-automatic or fully automatic cameras.
That was my 16-year-old first high school photography class camera was the XGM. I really should go and find one. Gas is not addictive, right?
No, it's not. It's an autoimmune disorder.
But what makes the XGM stand out is that it has the full manual mode and full metered manual mode, and that honestly is what drew me to it. When I first picked it up and first started working with it again, it honestly, it felt like home, because again, I'd worked with the X7A in the past, and it just, for a 1980s camera, this thing is pretty darn impressive. It's small, it's light, it's compact, it's a camera that I would take on an important trip with me. It would be one I'd tuck in a laptop bag with me if I was going on a work trip or going to work. It's just, overall, I think it's a great camera. There are a couple of sticking points.
They're like a dime a dozen, too. Like, if you lose it or drop it, you're not going to lose that much sleep over it.
So. Yeah, exactly. And although not
yours,
to mention,
yours is in beautiful shape.
I got mine from Trevor. Yeah.
And that 45 f2 Roker lens.
Yeah.
That is a nice piece of glass.
So I was smart. When I sold off my X7A, I sold off all the third party glass. I kept the Rockor glass. And I kind of thought, like, should I? No, I should keep this. And I just tucked away, thinking, like, you know, you never know what I might end up with another Minolta camera, and sure enough, I did. The back release, bit flimsy, and the on-off switch, where it indicates whether your camera is on and off, is hidden behind the film advance lever. So there's no real. I mean, the switch itself is on the opposite side of the shutter speed dial. But overall, I think this is an absolutely fantastic camera, and the Rockor glasses is absolutely amazing. I have the 135, the 50, the 45, and a 28 millimeter. And when my wife and I go to Disney in the fall, it's the XGM that's coming with me, for the very reason that, you know, if it gets damaged, it gets lost, gets thrown up on by some kid, I can just replace it dirt cheap. And the meter in it's fantastic. It's just so incredibly easy to use. And even with my big hands, the camera fits well. It's ergonomic, it's easy to use. Honestly, if you want to get into SLR photography and you don't have any existing system that you can use your lenses on, I'm talking more of the Canon EOS system here, the Minolta is a cheap way to get into that level of photography. Bill, you're a Minolta man also.
Yep, I actually, oh boy, there's a long convoluted story there. I had Minolta.
Wait a minute here. Bill is not just a Minolta man. Bill is a Nikon fanboy.
Who has a lot of Canon, Minolta.
A lot of Canon stuff, and like, God, like, how many Olympus bodies do you have?
He's a well-rounded individual.
Apparently.
I have been accused by acquaintances that I have, like, the SLR museum of the cameras that mattered.
Right?
Yeah, Minolta, yeah, I've got currently, I think, a pair of SRT-101s, a 102, an XE7, which I had overhauled courtesy Gary's camera in Illinois. I've got an XD11, which I think Trevor was like drooling over a few weeks ago when he last saw it. And I have an XD, which is the Japan market version of that, that's on its way back from Gary. So, yeah, I've got a fair-sized Minolta kit as well. And I highly agree. Yeah, you can't go wrong with the XGM off on a trip to Disney World. Actually, it'd be kind of cool because you kind of have that. It's the amateur camera from the 80s, and if you use some like consumer grade color film, you get almost a very specific look to it.
Yeah. I'm shooting all black and white at Disney. Might be the happiest place on earth, but I see everything grayscale.
Okay. Well, whatever turns you on. We don't judge around this table.
What?
Oh, we really? Judge. We just don't say it out loud.
We just judge you behind your back.
Your pictures might end up being a little bit Mickey Mouse.
Come on now. Be nice to Bill. He just doesn't say now no
and
to
last,
a nice body.
But certainly not least, John Meadows.
Or a cheap one.
Okay, I don't have the I don't have the camera with me today, but I'm going to talk about a Nikon camera that actually sort of got me back into film photography. Because my for a lot of years I had my Yashica Teal Electro. That got talked about in a recent episode.
Yep.
And had that up until the birth of my first daughter. Then I said, well, now that I have a daughter, time to go buy something a bit newer. So I got a Nikon FG. It did not last very long. The circuit board just fried.
Yeah.
And so eventually, like I sort of went to the dark side and shot some digital for a while. But then I ended up, I got a Nikon N6006 online. Did not pay a whole lot of money for it. And it's not a bad little camera. You know, it's built-in winder. I guess it's sort of similar. Sort of reminds me a bit of like one of the integrated Nikon cameras without a battery grip.
Auto or manual focus?
This was manual focus, at least what I had, at least the lens I had.
Okay.
Yeah, and not a bad camera. Like they're really sort of poo-pooed. Like they're in that list of El Cheapo Nikon cameras that people don't like to talk about. But it worked pretty well. I haven't used it in years. The big negative thing about that camera is that it uses a sort of a non-standard battery. I forget the designation, but it's one of those fairly fat. It almost looks like a digital battery.
Like one of the $30 batteries.
One of the $30 batteries, yeah. And No, I don't like cameras that take $30 batteries. No, thank you.
Well, that was the 80s for you, isn't it, though? Like, I mean, like, that's, like, there's so many good things that came out of the 80s and so many, like, head shakers, like proprietary battery design. Let me see. What's another big one? Starts with an A and ends with an S. I think there's a P in the middle.
Well, I thought when you A to S, there's a problem there. It says, unless it's a four-letter word.
No, I'm referring to APS film.
I thought APS was more of a 1990s thing.
It could have been, yeah.
Yeah.
It was kind of, yeah, it was 90s. I liked
APS. That's a whole other episode. But
we've done APS before. It was not a popular episode.
It's a piece of shit.
Apart from the expensive battery, the metering was great. Like, I remember I shot a roll of slide, my first roll of slide film that I'd literally shot in about 20 or 30 years. I shot in this camera, and of course, slide film is rather unforgiving when it comes to exposure, and it was bang on. So, yeah. if it weren't for the fact that the battery is expensive and unique, I'd still be using the camera today.
Yeah. Probably uses a 2CR5.
Something that the designation has a lot of dollar signs in it.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is Alex Loke signing out. Just saying, I'm glad I was born in the 80s but grew up in the 90s.
This is Bill Smith. I'm old enough to remember the 80s. The first time around, my high school was a John Hughes movie.
Oh, that's pretty good.
This is John Meadows. I'm the old guy here. Get off my lawn.
This is James Lee. F and A, baby. F and A.
This is Mike Pataxi, and have a great afternoon.
This is Donna Pataxi, and the 80s was the best year. Don't know what these guys are talking about. Keep that film rolling, guys.
Say Ferris.
You can keep that one in the end.
Oh, that was amazing. Oh,
too bad we can't.